Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
You're listening to the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and a member of the Christians for Liberty Network. My guest today is Stephan Kinsella. He's a patent attorney, or actually, are you a retired patent attorney, or are you still working in the field?
I'm retired.
Retired, okay. He's an advocate of the repeal of intellectual property laws. In fact, you kind of wrote the book on IP in the libertarian world, in my opinion. And he's a prolific libertarian writer and editor. The latest release that you worked on is Rothbard at 100, A Tribute and Assessment. So, Stephan, thanks for talking with the Libertarian Christian Podcast again.
Hey, glad to be here.
Well, I'll start with a softball. What's Rothbard at 100 about, and what made you want to publish it?
Well, of course, there's lots of books by Rothbard and even about Rothbard. He's probably the single most important figure in the modern libertarian movement. And I've been a writer myself and a longtime libertarian, and Rothbardian sort of anarcho-capitalist is the word a lot of people use. I don't really use that term too much anymore, but I've had some publishing experience too. So I've actually done several books of my own, but also edited books. And I've done two things that are called, in German, they're called Festschrifts, which is like a memory book. I did the first Festschrift for Hans Hoppe in 2009 with Guido Holzmann. And that's like a collection of tributes to a notable thinker, like at some occasion, like on their graduation or their retirement or something like that. And then two years ago, Guido and I did a second one for Hans too on his 75th birthday. So I've done two of these types of books, and Rothbard's 100th birthday was coming up in March this year, just a couple months ago. And Hans was his closest sort of student and friend. Hans Hoppe moved to the U.S. in 1985 to live and study with Rothbard, and he taught with him at UNLV for the last 10 years of Rothbard's life, from 1985 to 95. So he's sort of the chief intellectual libertarian theorist who's also someone who's deeply influenced by Rothbard's ideas. And Hans, and he also a dear friend of Rothbard. And Hans contacted me a few months before that date and said, you know, I don't really see anyone else preparing what should be a tribute to Rothbard on his 100th birthday. And we have a lot of scholars affiliated with Hans's group based in Turkey called the Property and Freedom Society, which are very learned Rothbardian type scholars, Austrians and libertarians and lawyers and historians and that type. So he said, why don't we put together a little book? And I was just going to do 5 or 10 articles, but we turned out to have an embarrassment of riches. And we ended up having, I think, 20 chapters in the book. And it worked out nicely because about 9 of the chapters are by people who actually knew Rothbard, who at least met him or knew him. Including me. I met him one time in 1994 before he died. And then, so the book is about half essays by people who met Rothbard and knew him, and half by people who never met him but were deeply influenced by him. So we divided the book up that way. In the past, when I've done Festschrifts, Guido Holzmann and I, we separate the tributes into sections. Like the beginning section is like more personal tributes from someone who's not like a deep scholar, like a wife or a son or a child of the honoree, and then the scholarly essays we would sort into categories. And this one, it was just 20 essays, so I just did, you know, people who knew Rothbard and people who were influenced by Rothbard. So it was nice, and it's a really nice set of essays. It was good to do it. We didn't have time to get the book ready in print for March 2nd because it was a last minute project, but we announced it and released it digitally online on the Property and Freedom site on March 2nd on his birthday. And it's been well received, and I think it's a really nice book. Right now we are preparing the paper version and the Kindle version and the EPUB and the PDF and all that, which will be released free online shortly. And we're publishing that in time for another conference in tribute to Rothbard in Porto, Portugal on June 27th, organized by Manuel Oganda and some four or five groups in Portugal. So that's a nice event that's going to happen June 27th. And it will have be mostly Portuguese speakers and language, but Hans Hoppe will be there. I will be there. Saifedean Ammous will be there. And some others will be there. And also they will be releasing the Portuguese translation of my book, Legal Foundations of a Free Society, which I published in 2023. So that should be a nice event. So I'm working on getting the book. I just printed, I have behind me some books I published, but I don't have the Rothbard book yet, but I printed out the cover. So that will be the cover.
I like it. That's nice.
We thought about doing all gold, but I thought a little bit of contrast would be nice, black and gold for Rothbard.
Sure.
So yeah, I'm excited about that. It was a fitting tribute and it was good that we could get it done.
Yeah, I love it. Well, and so you kind of have said this, but just to clarify, at the time that we're recording this, this can all be read online digitally, but yes, there's a Kindle version and a physical version that's coming. You're thinking, yes, maybe by end of June, around the time of the Porto conference, it'll be available?
Probably before then, because I'm going to bring copies with me. So I'm thinking mid-June, it will be available for purchase online. Okay. And plus, I will also post on the PFS website a free EPUB and a free PDF, because we're not trying to make money off of this. We're trying to spread the ideas of liberty and Rothbard, which, again, is something that I'm disappointed with. And a lot of my fellow libertarians and scholars who copyright and paywall their books, and they're either too stupid or lazy to make them available for free. I mean, just as an example, my friend Tibor McCann, who died, I don't know, 10 years ago, he has lots of great books, but they're gone. You can't get them now because they're under copyright and they're paywalled and they're dusty. You know, some of these older scholars, I understand why you have to chase the academic ring and all this when you're younger, or you're too, you don't know how to do self-publishing. That wasn't really a thing 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're older and your books are fading, why don't you just like pay someone $100 to digitize it and put a free PDF online if you don't want your ideas to disappear? I don't understand that. You know, coincidentally, I'm working with George Reisman right now. He is, you know, he's widowed. He has no children. He's a Randian, so he's in favor of IP. Mm-hmm. But he worked his life on his ideas, so he has worked with me to open source his capitalism book and other lectures of his. He's like 90, he's almost 90 now. So when he passes, his work will be public domain, because he's actually thinking about the future. And I wish more scholars would think that way. We do. So this will be available for free for everyone and for purchase if people want a nice deluxe edition.
Awesome. Love it. Well, and so those who are maybe caught a little bit of this conversation about IP, we did publish, I did an interview with you before I was with the Libertarian Christian Institute on IP, but that is, we made it available recently on the Libertarian Christian podcast. So folks can go back and get that. Within the last year, we republished that, and great conversation. And for those who want to dive deeper, your book on intellectual property is fantastic also.
And you guys have a new edition of your book coming out, right? Your book about Christians and libertarianism, liberty and freedom.
Faith Seeking Freedom. I don't remember. I know it's coming out pretty soon, but I don't remember the exact date. But and yeah, I also don't know exactly how we copyright that stuff, or if we do. I know my own independent stuff, when I publish stuff, I always make it public domain or you know, available for people to copy. But sometimes when you work with other people, you gotta go along with what they want to do.
I know. I've had that dilemma myself many times. And I reviewed your book the first time, and I think I've given a blurb for the second version, and I reviewed it, and it's really an excellent work. I mean, quite often a second edition is just, you know, a few tweaks, but this one is like 30% longer or something, right? It's got a lot of new material in the second edition.
Yeah, there's a lot. Yep. Well, so thank you for putting a plug in for that. But as we're talking about Rothbard, so you mentioned that you started with essays from people who knew him personally.
Yes.
Was the rationale there to kind of, you know, because people sometimes can idolize the ideas of somebody, but maybe not necessarily know a lot about that person. Was the idea to kind of flesh him out, or what was the rationale of the personal connection?
Well, there was no rationale. It just happened to be that we just wanted to get authors who had something meaningful to say about Rothbard. So that would be people who admired his thought. And so almost everyone in the book is a scholar of one type or the other. I mean, like Thomas Jacob is a libertarian, and he he's in the first section. He met Rothbard. In fact, the cover image is based upon a photo he sent me. By the way, that was partly a copyright thing. So I contacted the Mises Institute because I wanted to find a photograph to use for the cover. And there's some nice portrait of Rothbard on the website. And I said, well, I would like to use this for the cover of this. And I was told, well, there's a photographer who has a copyright. We need to know what this is for. So I started getting all this kind of guff. I said, screw it. I'm not going to use any kind of well-known work because of copyright problems. So one of my friends, Thomas Jacob, who's got a chapter in the book, he sent me his personal photograph that he had taken of Rothbard. And so I had no copyright problems with that one. But this is just another example how copyright can impede publications and freedom of expression and freedom of speech. But by the way, so I didn't know this because I don't speak German, but the word Festschrift means like a book of fond memories or something of someone. But this one is someone who's died already. And so the German word for this one is called Gedenkenschrift, which means like a memory book. So it's like a book of essays in honor. But in any case, we happen to have so many people that are followers of Hans Hoppe and Rothbard who are affiliated with the Property and Freedom Society that when I started asking, and we wanted to get people that were affiliated only with the PFS. There were other people we know, like with the Mises Institute, who could have contributed, but we wanted to get people that were, this was a PFS publication, so it was people that are affiliated with us. And we just happened to have 20 different people who knew a lot about Rothbard. So almost every chapter in the book is substantive. There's one or two that are more about my memories of meeting Rothbard, like I think by Leah Glody and Jeff Barr, who Rothbard taught. So it's about like his last class. I mean, Doug French talks about that and Thomas Jacob, but most of the essays are substantive. So we just, like Guido Hofmann, for example, took a chapter of one of his books, which was only published previously in French and German, and he updated that chapter and translated it into English. And that's a chapter in the book. So they're just different types. I could have organized it by subject matter, but it wasn't really necessary. It's just a good tribute to him and another indication of how important his thought is. If you can get someone on your 100th birthday to write another, I mean, there was a Festschrift done to Rothbard and he was alive. You got to remember, Rothbard died when he's only like 67 or 8. He was young when he died. Unfortunately, he could have lived longer. He died in 95, right at the dawn of the internet age. I mean, imagine Rothbard in the age of the internet with all the stuff he would have had available at his fingertips.
Yeah, I'd be great to be retweeting Rothbard right now. Yeah. So, I mean, and I wondered if I should do a kind of a who is Rothbard sort of question, but I assume anybody who's listening to this saw Rothbard in the title and kind of already knows who he is, but he's obviously an important, hugely important figure in the anarcho-capitalist movement in particular, libertarianism in general. Yep. And so to take that question, make it a little personal, what do you see as his single most enduring contribution to libertarian thought, and how has that shaped your own work?
That's interesting. So people that aren't really that familiar with it, let me just kind of give an overview or background of what he means to me and why I did this book. So on propertyandfreedom.org, if you just go to the book section, you'll find the book. And on that book page, we have all the chapters for the book and all the content. But also I have a lot of links to information, other commentary on Rothbard, like his Festschrift and books he's written. He was a very prolific author, so opinions would vary on what are his most important works. It's hard to identify some, the most key things, because unlike someone else who specialized in one or two things, he has a lot of influence. Now, let me also say this. So I'm 60 years old. I've been a libertarian since I've been about 15 years old. And I believe that the modern libertarian movement is about 70 years old. I think is different than what came before it, which was the old right and classical liberalism. It's a progenitor. I mean, those are progenitors, but I do think it's different. So I would say the modern libertarian movement started with Ayn Rand and then Murray Rothbard, and then other key figures like Milton Friedman and Leonard Reed and Henry Hazlitt, guys like that, and Hayek to a degree. But it's primarily Rand that got it started, I think, with her books. And Rothbard actually learned from Rand. But Rothbard was more systematic and systematized, and he became more radical and an anarchist. And he's also more of an economist and more Austrian under Mises. Now, I would say there's a big second wave of libertarianism with the Ron Paul campaign in 2008. I think that radically expanded numbers of libertarians. I'd say it probably quadrupled in size, the number of libertarians. So in today's world, the vast bulk of libertarians, unlike before 2008, when you would say most libertarians were heavily influenced by Ayn Rand and Rothbard to a degree, and most of them were, I would say up until that point in time, most of them were like a minarchist, that is, not radical anarchist. I don't know, if I had to guess, I'd say it was like one-fourth were anarchist and three-fourths were minarchist. After Ron Paul, however, they were also more well-read and more literate. Like most of them had read, like they were studious. They had read Ayn Rand. They had read Mises. They had read Rothbard, like the actual books. After Ron Paul, the numbers swelled. And because of Ron Paul's connection to the Mises Institute and Austrian economics and monetary policy, I would say today's libertarians are much more anarchist and Rothbardian. It's a more radical in a sense. At the same time, they're a little bit less well-read because of they consume information by YouTube and TikTok and podcasts. And they're a little bit more activist because they came in through the Libertarian Party or through the Ron Paul movement. So a lot of them tend to burn out more. Like they come in, they don't see results, and they burn out. I call them waystation libertarians or something like that. So it's an interesting time to be here. So that's where I think Rothbard's place is one of the key intellectuals of the early libertarian movement, but his influence is still there. His presence is still there. As for his work, he's really known for his Austrian economics and for his talk about the banking system, the monetary system. He's also known for his ethics of liberty. I mean, to my mind, his key works would be The Ethics of Liberty and For a New Liberty, his two treatises on libertarian philosophy, and also his Man, Economy, and State, and Power and Market, which is two sort of economic treatises. But also he wrote a history of America called Conceived in Liberty. He wrote a history of economic thought. So he's made so many contributions in different areas. He was so active in the libertarian movement. So there's a lot to dive into there. And that's what, and you get a sense of that in the book. I mean, normally when you do a book, there's a lazy way and there's a harder way, right? And because we were doing this on a shoestring budget, and luckily, by the way, we got some donors who helped support the book. I was going to foot the bill myself, which I don't mind doing. And it would, people think if you're a podcaster, you know this. If you're a podcaster, if you publish a book, you're rich. I mean, you usually make no money on these things. You usually lose money, which is fine by me. This is a hobby for me. But there's two ways to do it. You can do it the easy way, and it's pretty easy with Kindle and Kindle Direct Publishing and all this now. But for a book this important, I wanted it to last, especially after we got 20 good chapters. But normally you wouldn't. So I wanted an index, which I'm having an index done, which takes money and time. And a lot of books don't have an index because it takes money and time. But I also was going to skip the bibliography because when you have a book with 20 chapters, every chapter is a self-contained work. And it doesn't always make sense to have a master bibliography for the whole book because there's no unifying theme. But in this one, after I edited it, I realized there's a lot of common threads between them. And there was such a wealth of material that we had footnoted basically in the footnotes or across all the chapters, and I did all the work. So I decided to accumulate it, and I'm glad I did because it's like a 20 page bibliography, which I just love these things. I mean, some people hate them. Some people hate footnotes. I'm a footnote obsessive. The reason I love footnotes is you can ignore them if you want to. And by the way, I hate endnotes. I love footnotes and I hate endnotes because endnotes, you have to flip to the back of the chapter. Yeah. Whereas I like to read them. So it's at the bottom of the page. I love them. Some people are annoyed by them. But anyway, this is my geeky side. But I love footnotes and I love publishing and all this stuff. But I'm so happy that the book, you can see from the heft of the bibliography how well documented and well read and thoughtful all the chapters are and all the authors are in the chapter of the Gedankenschrift.
I think you maybe had a hard time distilling down to just one thing because of all the work he's done in history and economics and philosophy and ethics.
Yeah.
But your piece does also mention some areas where maybe you disagreed with Rothbard. Is there something significant that stands out?
Yeah. So yeah, I'll mention my chapter, but let me first mention. So what Rothbard did was I believe Mises was one of the greatest thinkers, if not the greatest maybe of all time, but certainly of the 20th century. His praxeology and his sort of methodological reformulation of Austrian economics, which he got from Karl Menger and those guys, but he made it more formal and systematic. It's really amazing. But even then, he has some missteps because of his sort of mainstream take on some things. So Rothbard, for example, corrected one thing, which was Mises' monopoly theory. Like, you know, so Rothbard's like, no, you just... And that's because he was willing to say that because he's a radical libertarian. Now, this was not a libertarian view, but the point is we have to reformulate even the classical view that there's a monopoly on the free market, which is what antitrust laws and competition laws in Europe are about. So Rothbard's like, no, there's if you have a pure understanding of economics, which is what his reworking of Mises was, you'll see that there's no such thing as a monopoly on a free market. All the monopolies are actually caused by concentrated legal power of the state. And yet the state exempts itself from its monopoly laws and aims its monopoly power at non-monopolies on the free market. So that was an important contribution of Rothbard. Now, what's interesting about Rothbard was he was heavily influenced by Aristotle and Ayn Rand. So sort of that tradition that's more Aristotelian. So Mises was influenced by the terminology and the conceptual categories of Kant, which, of course, according to Ayn Rand, is the Antichrist. You know, to me, this is all silly. These are all just different concepts and words and labels we use to understand in abstract forms the concept workings of the universe using our powers of reason. I mean, if there was another species on another planet that happened to come up with free market economic thinking, they wouldn't have the same language or terms because they'd have a different history and a different biology and a different, you know, a different past, but we'd be describing the same reality. And I think that's really what happens and you can see that in the work of Rothbard because he uses a more Aristotelian terminology, but he's still able to incorporate in the a priori and the Kantian categories of Kant and Mises. He just puts a little bit more of an Aristotelian spin on it. So that is one thing that's different. Now, Hoppe, who was his greatest student, came along, and he's more in the Kantian, German, Misesian side of things. So he uses more of Mises' terminology, and I actually think it's superior. I think Mises and Kantian terminology are superior. But in any case, we're all describing the same reality. Now, Rothbard had a really good take on human rights and natural rights based upon common sense, John Locke, natural law reasoning. That's in his Ethics of Liberty, which is an important book. Now, in my book, The Legal Foundation of Free Society, which is heavily influenced by the thought of Mises and Hoppe and Rothbard and also others like Rand and others, I decided to, for this book on Rothbard, my chapter is a kind of a distillation of why I think, in my mind, if you want to have a sound understanding of modern political economy, right? Libertarian theory, Austrian theory, free market theory, the state, human liberty. The most important thinkers in my mind are Mises, Rothbard, and Hoppe. Those three together, now, they're not enough, and there's a lot of other important thinkers out there, but those three, to my mind, are the most influential on me, but I think they are the most important if you want to have a solid understanding that you can build on, which I've tried to do. Yeah. And I explain
I think you refer to them as the indispensable framework for understanding and addressing politics and economics, which I like.
Yeah, and I got that title. The title of my chapter is let me get it right, Mises, Rothbard, and Hoppe, an indispensable framework. And I took that's a nod to Rothbard because in two of his books, he dedicated the books to his wife, Joey Rothbard, who I met too. And he called it to Joey the indispensable framework. So that was nice. He was basically dedicating two of his most important books to his wife. So I took that. So, but yeah, I do criticize Rothbard. I think he makes several errors and it's understandable why he was pioneering in so many areas. In my view, Rothbard's most important contribution is one that's overlooked. And I was on the Tom Woods show a few years ago talking about that. That's his contract theory. And what's so impressive about it is he's not a lawyer. And neither was Williamson Evers. So Williamson Evers and Rothbard together came up with this title transfer theory of contract, which I've written on in detail. And I'm a lawyer and I'm a legal scholar, so I built on that. But they came up with something that's radically different and better than everyone else's centuries of contract theory, in my view. Now, of course, a non-lawyer who's coming up with a pioneering theory, in addition to a dozen other pioneering contributions he's made in other areas like history and libertarian theory and, you know, monopoly theory and, you know, so many other things, that he would make a mistake is understandable. I mean, he is, you know, he moved on to something else. So, but that's what you do, is you count on other people to take your work up and assess it, put it into a different context, and show some mistakes they made. And he did make a few mistakes. And quite interestingly, a lot of them relate to intellectual property, which he also made some mistakes on. He made the mistakes, I think, because, and this is one of my criticisms, or one of my, the points, the things I point out in my chapter, is that the reason all three thinkers are important, Mises, Rothbard, and Hayek, is Mises's basically praxeology is crucial to analyzing the implications of human action, both ethically and politically and economically. But Mises was not a radical anarchist, so you need more than him. Rothbard added the radical politics, I mean, radical more than Ayn Rand, like not just monarchy, but willing to criticize the entire state. But then Hobbes returned to the Misesian emphasis on scarcity, which is embedded in praxeology, because he didn't lose the Kantian sort of roots of Mises. Whereas I think Rothbard lost the emphasis on scarcity because he was focusing so much on production and human action and his economic theories that, you know, it was there, but he didn't focus on it. If he had focused on it, he would have realized that the mistake he made in his intellectual property theory and in some of his other writing is that he was thinking that production is key, like Ayn Rand did. And therefore, he didn't stop to say, well, if you produce something, if you create something, right? That's the Randian view. Do you own it? You have to first ask, is it the type of thing that can be owned? So in praxeology, which I point out in my chapter, we focus on human action, which uses scarce means of action, okay? But the second part, which is not really focused on by these writers, except until Hoppe, is knowledge. You have to have two things to have successful action. You have to have available scarce resources or means of action, and you have to have knowledge, which guides action. And once you see that those are both equally important and they're both essential to successful human action, you see that they're different. And the reason we have property rights is because of conflict among the scarce means. And that's what property rights are about. And that's what scarcity is about. But having property rights in information that guides action makes no sense. And in fact, it would lead to conflict with property rights in the scarce things, which is basically my intellectual property critique.
Hey, everyone, it's Doug from LCI. As you may know, the team at Podsworth Media has worked with us for a long time, producing our content for most of the Christians for Liberty Network. A big part of that over the past couple of years has been using the Podsworth app to make our audio sound clean, level, and professional, even when the raw recordings were super sketchy, like this one you're listening to right now. Believe it or not, this recording was that bad before I ran it through the Podsworth app, and you can hear the full before and after demo yourself at podsworth.com. The app recently got a huge update, and it's now better than ever. So good, in fact, that it can take almost any atrocious voice recording and make it sound great. Here's how it works. It removes background noise, cuts down on plosives, fixes clipping when your gain is too high, removes clicks and pops, reduces reverb, improves tone, and levels out the dialogue so that you don't get any crazy volume jumps. Everybody hates that in a podcast. Using it is super simple. You just go to podsworth.com and click Get Started, drag and drop the audio files, open them right up from your phone's browser, customize your settings however you want, but honestly, the default works great for most settings, and here's the really cool thing. If you enter code LCI50, you'll get 50% off your first order. No account needed, just your email and payment. You'll get a download link in your inbox with cleaned up files. It's perfect for podcasts, YouTube videos, sermons, audiobooks, you name it. If your recording sounds rough, the Podsworth app can make it not only sound listenable, but professional. And remember, when you use code LCI50, you get half off your first order, and you'll also be supporting the work here at LCI.
Rothbard lost sight of that, and that's what, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. So to kind of sum up maybe and put it another way, as I understand you, if you, you can tell me if I'm wrong about this, is that the reason we have disputes about physical property is because it's scarce. It, you know, there can be a dispute about who owns it or who can use it.
Yes.
Whereas ideas are not that way. So if you know, caveman Oog goes out and discovers fire and, you know, some another caveman sees him do it, he can copy that approach without taking anything from Oog, right? And that's not the same way with a house or a you know, cell phone or whatever.
And that's a crucial insight. And of course, I get called a communist because, oh, you don't believe in property rights and ideas. I'm like, well, the reason we're richer than the Romans is not because we're smarter than the Romans. I mean, if you've seen the movie Idiocracy, you could argue that we're actually getting stupider, right? Because of the welfare system or whatever, or whatever the word is for when your intelligence goes down as a species, you know. But the reason we're richer is because we've accumulated more and more technological knowledge over the centuries. Like that keeps growing. Hayek talks about this. He calls it the fund of experience. And so when you need to act in the world, you need to have knowledge and scarce resources. The scarce resources in the world haven't changed that much. It's, you know, there's dirt and there's plants and there's iron ore. It's just what we can do with it because we have more knowledge. So the way knowledge expands is because it's replicable and people can learn. Learning is a good thing, right? And they learn by emulating and by observing and by passing down information and by competing with each other. When you see someone do something that works better, when someone can catch more fish because they have a net instead of doing it with their hands or with a spear, then people start emulating that. When they see people living in a cave instead of like in the, you know, out in the open, they start doing that. They emulate what they see that works. Learning is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. It's not stealing. It's learning.
Even if the other you know, prehistoric man says, hey, it was my idea to live in a cave. You got to give me a percentage on
and this
your
is
food.
Where the, one of the famous one of the famous old right libertarians, Robert Lefebvre, has this thing about the ambiguities in the English language. I mean, so many words have different meanings, and this leads to confusion if you're not careful about it, which is why I'm sometimes accused of being pedantic when I stop and I want you to define a term, because I've already seen the potential for equivocation or dishonesty or just confusion. If you're not clear about, like, you know, when people say they're against the government, what they really mean is they're against the state, for example. Mm-hmm. But if Lefebvre points out that, like, for example, the word my, like my idea, you said, that's a possessive in the English language. And it has different connotations and different meanings. I mean, if I say my country, it's a way of identifying where I'm from, but it doesn't mean I own the country. If I say my wife, it doesn't mean I own my wife.
Right.
If I say my car, it does mean I own my car. So the use of a possessive, it doesn't always mean ownership. Just like the use of a word or a label to identify a phenomena in the universe doesn't mean you're describing an existing object that is the type of thing that can be owned. So for example, if I say that ideas are useful, that is true. Knowledge is useful and essential. That is true. But it doesn't mean that it, quote unquote, exists like a scarce resource, like a table or a chair or a banana. That's the type of thing over which there can be physical conflict, over which there needs to be property rights to prevent this physical conflict. So the first question people miss is, you don't say, who owns that idea? You have to say, is it the type of thing that can be owned?
Right.
So the caveman came up with a new way of cooking food, and another guy saw that. Oh, I don't have to eat the food raw. I can cook it over fire. So he learned, and that way humanity improves over time.
So yeah, when someone says you stole my idea, there's a lot of loaded terms we have to kind of discern what means. When we say stole, well, we don't actually mean that you took it and I don't have it anymore.
Right.
And also when I say my idea, it's not like I'm saying, you know, my smartphone. It's not a genitive of ownership. It's a genitive of origination, something like that. Right.
Yes. It's like attribution or credit. So like if someone says, and that's the issue in terms of attribution for like a painting, like who painted the Mona Lisa?
Yeah.
Well, if it was, who was it?
Oh no, that was a Da Vinci.
Da Vinci. So if Da Vinci was alive, he would say, I painted it. So I'm the author. But so if he said it's my painting, he doesn't mean he might have sold it. He might not own the painting. So what he means is I'm the one who painted it. And if you want to be accurate, historically accurate and say who give credit to someone, that's what attribution's about. It got nothing to do with property rights or even honesty, or it's just being accurate. Whereas if you said, whose car is that? Now you're asking who has a title to it, who bought it or who created it. Anyway, these words have different meanings and they can trip you up if you're not careful. And you have to sometimes be careful about these terms.
Yeah. Well, and so I love the IP discussion, but I do want to make sure we're able to promote the book as well. So you talked about the relationship of, you know, Rothbard to Mises, that Rothbard was kind of a disciple of Mises. You've also talked about these places where maybe Rothbard got things wrong because he's sort of an innovator. He's sort of figuring this out. And you could argue that the history of liberal thought is a lot like that. What we call classical liberalism was this incredible idea that I think we would say leads logically to libertarianism, but not everybody figured that out, right? So there was this kind of process of working that out in real time. And so now that being said, some of us are more inclined than others to establish purity tests. And so, you know, so for example, Rothbard was kind of a disciple of Mises, but he also went on to call him, according to the book, part of the non-communist left due to his kind of minarchist viewpoints, which I thought was an interesting
Rothbard called Mises part of the non-communist left?
Yeah, there was an essay in the book where I can't remember who said that, but it was somebody who knew Rothbard.
Yeah.
And which I thought was a really funny state, but I think he was sort of being a little tongue in cheek. But you know, today libertarians are going to argue over things like differences in about like immigration, intellectual property, racism, strategic voting. Do those things disqualify someone's claim to be a libertarian if they're on the other side of that than I am? And so I am curious, what are your thoughts on ideological purity tests to determine who's in the tent and who isn't, in light of the fact that, you know, Rothbard was directionally very correct, but he got a few things wrong also.
So my take on that is, you know, human understanding is human. The application of human reason to understand the world is, I won't call it an art, but it's not a precise science. The ultimate purpose of everything we do intellectually is cognitive, is to understand things, is to identify things about the world. And because we're not just instinctual animals, we have brains and minds that are pretty complex, and it allows us to go far beyond what animals can do, mere animals can do. But there's also the possibility of mistake, especially because we have these high-level concepts and they're built upon other concepts. And the more abstract you get, the more potential for error and confusion there is. So I think it's sort of a common sense or practical art to use words appropriately, to have definitions and to categorize and classify things. And so one thing we do is, among political philosophies, is we separate people by what they believe about the use of force and the state and things like that. So we have concepts like fascist or statist or welfare statist, you know, theocrat, minarchist, anarchist, utilitarian. I mean, we have these terms, but their purpose is for utility, is to be practical, to help us identify reality. So one of them is the word libertarian, or the concept libertarian. It has a certain meaning, and people can debate the definition and the meaning, but over time, you know, words tend to have a meaning in practice. And given that, I think what you can do is you can identify what your own views about libertarianism is. And you can even, if you're somewhat self-honest, you could say, I'm a libertarian 92%, but I don't agree with this part. Or you could have the view that I'm a libertarian and my view of libertarianism is right, and I'm 100% libertarian. That's sort of like my view. Like, I think I'm pretty much 100% libertarian because that's my goal, is to do that. And so by my standard of what libertarianism is, I would say someone who believes in intellectual property is not a libertarian to that extent. Whether you want to use that as an excuse to ostracize someone or read them out of the movement is more of a tactical or strategic thing or a personal thing. I don't really have any strong views on that. I think it's a little bit silly, usually. I think it's just best to say, I just think you're wrong for these reasons. And you're wrong that the libertarian principles that you say you agree with me on imply that. And here's why. Let's get to the bottom of it. Now, if you're having a discussion with or about a non-libertarian, like, you know, a typical Democrat or someone like that, there's no pretension and there's no pretense that we both share some common roots. I mean, there's something we share at the bottom. If they're not a total misanthrope and they want the human race to die, then they would agree that they in general agree with well-being and prosperity for everyone. They might agree with that. And then you have to go up from there. But they don't agree on economics, for example. They don't don't understand economics usually. They have a different understanding of economics. They think some things can be done for free, you know?
Sure.
You can print money and make people better.
Well, and there's a sense too, you know, in which whether you're a libertarian, a Republican, or a Democrat, you've sort of built your philosophy, maybe not always knowingly, on that kind of classical liberal foundation. Correct. So they've maybe diverged in some way, whereas hopefully we've gotten kind of more focused and more, you know, and thinking through the logical implications of it.
Well, plus we're trying to. Now, not everyone's trying to build a coherent, internally consistent. Like, consistency is not the main goal of everyone. That is sort of the goal of libertarians. And it's, I mean, you could say we're a little bit autistic or we're a little bit OCD in some sense, but that's what drives some of us to look for, we're trying to make ideas compatible. So if we have two ideas that seem to be incompatible, it bugs us and we want to say, well, which one's wrong? Because they can't both be right. But that leads to, that can lead to an improvement it has helped me in my case. Now, so what I will say is, in the case of Rothbard, I do think he's mistaken on a couple things. However, in if that was the way it was, it'd be fine. It's like, okay, he's great on 98% of everything, but he made a couple mistakes. Okay. I actually believe, and Hans Hoppe agrees with it too, in Rothbard's case, the couple things he went a little bit astray on, which was the implications of his contract theory. Do you want me to reset? You want me to reset? Are you okay with this?
I'm fine. We'll keep going. Hopefully everything will come out fine on the video when we're finally done. If I lose you, we'll start again, but I think we're all right.
Okay. So, like, for example, he made some mistakes in his own contract theory, which is pioneering, and he made a few mistakes in his attempts to grapple with the intellectual property issue. But Hoppe and I both believe that if he had just lived a little bit longer, he would have agreed 100% with me and with Hoppe about those two issues, because I understand his theory so well, and I see where he was going, and I think he would have said, oh yeah, because he did that with Hoppe's argumentation ethics. In 1988, Hoppe had this article in Liberty Magazine where he came up with his argumentation ethics defense of rights, and Rothbard praised it to high heaven and said, this is great, and it makes my own theory seem wimpy in comparison. So he was willing to admit that there was an improvement to some of his ideas. And not only that, in 1988, there was a panel at the Mises Institute with Rothbard and Hoppe and Leland Yeager and David Gordon, I believe. And someone asked Hoppe a question. This is 1988, before Tom Palmer, before I had written on IP at all, before it was a big issue. It became a big issue in 1995 with the internet, but before then it was sort of a minor issue. But someone asked Hoppe a question, what do you think about ownership of ideas? And because he's so steeped in praxeology and he understands the difference instinctively between means and ideas and information, he instantly said, you can't own ideas. Anyone who gets an idea can use it. So he was right. But the thing is, Rothbard was sitting next to him on that panel. Rothbard didn't say anything. So I think Rothbard would have been, and not only that, Rothbard has this really good essay in The Ethics of Liberty, which I wrote about in my recent chapter in the Hoppe Festschrift in 2024. It's about defamation law. So up until recently, I would say most libertarians have been, because they're Randian, because of the Ayn Rand influence, they believe in reputation rights because they believe in, and they believe in defamation law because of that, which is wrong. So Rothbard and Walter Block, until recently, are like two of the only ones who've had a good understanding of the problem with reputation rights and with defamation law. Basically, the idea is that you don't have the right to what other people think about you. And that's what a reputation right is. So people are free to think whatever they want about you. And so defamation law rests upon the idea that your reputation is being harmed, some property right you have, but you don't have a property right in what people think. So the point is, what Rothbard didn't realize, and which I point out in my article, is that reputation rights are very similar to trademark rights, which are a type of intellectual property. And the argument given for trademark rights is very close to the argument given for defamation rights. So, and Rothbard never wrote about trademark law that I know of. He easily would have seen that, oh yeah, defamation law is bad, but so is trademark law. And I think if he had seen that, then he would have said, oh, I agree. I made a mistake on copyright and patent. Those are also bad for the following reasons. Anyway, I'm pretty sure Rothbard would have seen it our way. Not that it matters. I mean, he could still have been mistaken about that and been great. But sure. I find it interesting that I think he would have improved.
Well, and so thinking about this kind of question of purity tests and, you know, the question of the tent, I kind of want to build on that a little bit in terms of, you know, kind of one way to think about it is kind of more pragmatic. Who do we coalition with? Who can we work with? Whatever. And at an earlier point in his career, Rothbard argued that libertarianism was really sort of a left-wing movement, doing part to its anti-war commitments, but for other reasons as well. And then over time, he sort of abandons this idea of a libertarian left-wing coalition, and he starts working with paleoconservatives like Pat Buchanan. Yeah. Even though he kind of privately admitted that, you know, quote, these people do not believe in individual rights.
Right.
And so following the example, the paleo move, we've seen other attempts from libertarians to coalition with those outside the movement. So the Mises Caucus sort of attempted to latch itself onto MAGA, yes, in some ways, and even offer some, yes, support for Trump. Is Rothbard's life a cautionary tale about compromising our values to make fake friends? Or, as a contributor Jeff Deist argues, a contributor to the book, was Rothbard's paleo coalition model really the correct one, and libertarians should continue to lean into finding common ground with the new right?
Well, that's interesting. So Rothbard had such an active life and he was so integral to the libertarian movement that, like I said, he's had so many contributions in different discrete areas, substantive contributions like to history and to economic theory, but also he was involved in the movement itself. So he was involved in the Libertarian Party. He was involved in Cato in the beginning. So he was also involved in activism. So he was trying to, you know, he was trying to convert people or make a difference. And one of the things he did was he allied with different people. He would ally with the left for anti-war reasons. I don't think it's a cautionary tale at all. I think there's nothing wrong with trying different things to increase liberty and to have allies. I have a blog post on my site. It's called The Three Fusionisms. And it's sort of about these three phases where there was an attempt to have what's called fusionism. And you're right, in a way, the Mises Caucus thing could be seen as like the fourth instantiation of that. Roughly speaking, there was an earlier fusionism with Frank Meyer and some libertarians. And then there was the one I came into when I met Rothbard in 1894. It was in D.C. at the John Randolph Club meeting, which was the Chronicles crowd and so-called paleo conservatives and the paleo libertarians. And then at Hoppe's PFS now, it's more Rothbardian, Hoppian, anarchist libertarian, but with some cautious interaction with conservatives, but I won't say putting them in their place, but making it clear that we're libertarians. You're welcome here. We can learn from you. But Hoppe learned and Rothbard learned that, yeah, the problem with these conservatives is they didn't want to learn their economics, really. Now, I think I've always struggled with this left-right thing. I've always said we're not left, we're not right, we're neither one. I don't like this attempt to pigeonhole us. But Hoppe had an essay about 10 years ago called, I think it's called A Realistic Libertarianism. It's on his website. And he points out that the essence, really, of the left and the right is that the left is egalitarian and the right is realistic. And what he means by that is the left, you know, they want, obviously, what egalitarianism is what Rothbard wrote about, too, in his egalitarianism book and stuff like that.
That's a revolt against nature.
That's clearly unlibertarian. It's unnatural. What Hoppe points out, so there's a lot of libertarians who are libertarian because they are anti-state and they're anti-authority in general. They're basically a libertine, so they don't want any rules. That's not my kind of libertarianism. I'm in favor of order and rules and elites and authority figures and hierarchy and capitalism and all that stuff. And in fact, I think that the state co-opts that stuff. And without the state, you would need and you would have more private hierarchy and rules and consequences for your behavior and things like that. And that's natural and that's perfectly fine. And that's what conservatives are good about. That's why I think there's always been more of a connection between the conservatives and the Republicans and the libertarians. The conservatives, some of them at least get it. They understand, they're willing to be realistic about the universe in the world. The left is just la-la land. So I would say that's basically right, that the right there's more potential synergy between us and the right because they're ultimately realistic and they're willing to recognize human nature and reality. You know, men are men, women are women. Some people are better than others or smarter or they're different. And they're just not, they're not rooted in this unrealistic egalitarianism. Now, but I still think that there's a difference between libertarianism and conservatism because we are more systematic and principled and have a really serious understanding of the nature of the state, right? Which mainstream conservatives don't want to admit because they would have to give up and change too much. Like they're too comfortable in this cocoon of the way the world looks at the state as our kind of father figure protector. And we just want to improve it, even though it's dangerous.
Yeah. Well, and you know, on that point, I think that I had a debate with sort of a friendly debate with LCI contributor Alex Bernardo on this, whether libertarian is primarily right or left wing. And he made a lot of the same arguments that you made. And I think our real position is it's neither, but you could kind of build sort of an argument for one or the other as kind of a, you know, a source or something like that. And but I think as I think about kind of listening to what you're saying there, I think that maybe the danger is that the far right, so libertarians are okay with difference as long as the idea of difference is not coming about through force or coercion or in some way undermining this idea of fundamental rights that all human individuals have. And I think what happens sometimes when you go too far to the right is difference is one of those things that in some way makes that difference is like more fundamental, that there are some human beings that are more human than others or have more rights than others. But when you go too far to the left, it's this kind of thing where all difference is indicative of some kind of evil that's being foisted on the world, right? And so that you don't want to go into this sort of Harrison Bergeron territory where the government is, you know, handicapping people who, you know, run too fast or whatever. And but on some level, you could sort of say, and this is a point that James Lindsay has been making as he's been critiquing libertarians on Twitter, is that and going after Hoppe in particular, that libertarianism is kind of a Marxist left wing philosophy because we see things in terms of a not oppressor oppressed exactly, but of a coercer coerced. But there's still this idea of a violence and an underclass. And that's kind of a left wing idea compared to the more right wing idea, which is more focused on civilization and barbarity, and the good guys are on the top and the bad guys are on the bottom. And so there's different ways.
And there's something to, I don't follow Lindsay that much, but there's something to that. I think maybe Phil Magnus has been going after Hoppe too. Hoppe has an essay, which is, I think, a great essay. It's called Marxist and Austrian Class Analysis. And he basically says that Marx basically was right in his class analysis, except he misidentified the classes. It's not, you know, it's not proletariat. What is it? It's not the bourgeoisie versus the proletariat or whatever it is. It's aggressor versus non-aggressor. And it's like the state's the biggest aggressor. So it's basically, it's aggression is how you exploit people and violate their rights. That's the libertarian view. And that is, so you can, that's why you've had people say, oh, there's tax eaters and there's tax slaves or whatever, you know, there's people that live off other people and there's people that are productive and they get taxed by the other people. There's people that are slaves and slave owners. I mean, there's a difference. And that's effectively what the classes are. And that's what the state does. And that's how the state exploits the people. And it's various support mechanisms, you know, all the corporations and people that are in bed with it. And they do it by maintaining this propaganda, this great fiction, which is the title of one of Hoppe's books, The Great Fiction. That's how they maintain this domination of people by thought control, by controlling education and the media and the maintaining this fiction that the state is necessary and is really, without the state, we would be even worse off. So we put up with its predations.
The left sort of makes any kind of difference or any kind of unpleasantry into violence. And then the only way to resolve that is through the defensive force of government violence to try to make us all equal again. Yeah. So it's, you know, there's something similar to what we're saying that the left is saying, but the difference is that we actually understand what violence is and isn't, and they don't. It's kind of maybe how I would look at it.
Do you want me to try to refresh my screen? Just refresh it.
Well, we're actually near the end because we want to try to keep it right around an hour. So, but I appreciate. I'm hoping that nobody will even know what we're talking about when we're talking about the frozen screen issue because all this is kind of all this is uploading in the background. So, if you're watching, hopefully everything's been fine. But so since we are getting close to the end, there's actually a lot of really interesting questions I've got, but I do want to probably start wrapping it up. And so maybe what we want to just kind of do now is talk, well, we just talked about the conference. We talked about the book and how those are coming out soon. The physical book is coming out soon. The Kindle book is coming out soon. But folks can read all the, can still read it online at propertyandfreedom.org, correct? And
the book is Rothbard. Of course, by the way, every year we have an annual meeting in Bodrum, Turkey in September, the annual meeting of the Property and Freedom Society. And we will be having that one this year. And we will have... of course, the book will be presented there, and we will have a panel on Rothbard there too. So that will be happening in September. But say we have the Portugal thing in June 27th, and then we will have the PFS meeting as well. And those will all be podcast and put on YouTube later.
Well, and you mentioned that the one in Porto is probably largely going to be Portuguese. Is the Property and Freedom meeting in Turkey going to be largely in English or multilingual?
Oh, it's always in English. The thing, I think in Turkey is always in English.
Okay. Well, and I'd love to talk to you a little bit more because I mentioned I've been kind of traveling a little bit more and getting interested in the kind of international community. I'd love to learn, talk to you a little bit more about the libertarianism as an international phenomenon because I think we tend to think of it as American and Europeans just don't think this way. But I know that that's not entirely true.
No, it's not. Not anymore.
Yeah. Not anymore. That's good. That's good news. Okay. Well, we're right at about an hour. So let's go ahead and maybe where can people find Rothbard at 100? Again, remind us of the link. And where can they find you and your work?
So propertyandfreedom.org, and there's a books link at the top, propertyandfreedom.org, which is the name of Hoppe's group, the PFS, the Property and Freedom Society. And then all my stuff is at stephankinsella.com. And I have a second site for the intellectual property stuff because to separate it, but that's c4sif.org. But you can find all those at Stephan Kinsella. And I'm on Twitter at nskinsella.
Okay, I'm going to make notes of that so I can make sure that they're in the show notes. And I'll also add... if anybody out there is thinking, hey, I speak a little Portuguese, Rothbard100.pt is the link for the conference that's going to be happening in Portugal at the end of June.
Well, and I understand that Manuel Legondo says that there will be live translations of things for the non-Portuguese speakers in the audience. So I think there will be some attempt to make it accessible to non-Portuguese speakers too.
Awesome. So if you don't speak Portuguese, but you're a libertarian and you've wanted to see the beauty of Porto, Portugal, then you could also do it. And Porto is one of the main cities in Portugal, so it's easy to fly in and from international flights, I believe.
Yes, I'm flying to Lisbon, but I'm taking a train to Porto and flying out of Porto.
Okay, fantastic. All right. Thank you so much, Stephan.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you liked today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.